Yo fam, this episode is a recording of a multi-part series, a workshop that I did for a teachers, counselors, and corrections conference. I am really proud of the workshop. I enjoyed it. The content is El Fuego. That's fire for you English speakers out there. And it reminds me, I was doing this this meditation I've been doing every day for, I don't know if it's been 90 days, but I've been doing it every day, and I have absolutely unlocked something emotionally. But I thought about this as a mission, you know, this big, hairy, audacious mission about what do I want to do with my life when I grow up. And the thing I keep coming back to is doing mental health and addiction workshops and basic level of care education in every school across the country. And what's interesting and what's important about that is I've got a level of care mental health tool that I like to talk about resources that are available in school for kids and parents that are in the school and in community. And I think that this is imperative if we want to really make headway in normalizing mental health and addiction services, which means getting people into services before they actually need them, instead of waiting for them to end up in jail or in rehab or in, you know, the hospital, suicidal, whatever that might look like. But if you know someone, a school, a university, a parent-teacher group, a conference, if you know someone, a counselor, a social worker, that would benefit from hearing a workshop like this, make sure you share it with them and let your boy know, because your boy's starting to travel. On two more episodes, this is 197, on 200, I'm going to drop the keynote I did at this same conference, and boy, was it good. Anyway, I love you. I'm thinking about you. Holler at your boy.
So grateful to be here. Is it a good assumption to think that everybody in here is some form of educator in the Department of Corrections or Youth Services?
Youth? Yes.
Something? Go. Perfect. Good. Good, good. Well, my name's Preston Moore. I work for a mental health and addiction hospital in Columbus. And so what I'm going to talk to y'all about as part of my presentation is what we call level of care education, which is what's the difference between inpatient, outpatient, residential, coaching, counseling, therapy, peer support, case management, right? We're going to talk about levels of care. But what this workshop is called, it's called Demystifying Mental and Emotional Health Care. Demystifying. To make simple mental and emotional health care. What the heck is that? Right? We often hear some other words thrown around like mental health care, addiction care, our health care system. So this workshop came out of the hospital I worked for. I've worked for them for about 4 years, but that's actually not where my experience really comes from. I didn't study addiction or mental health in college. I didn't do like any research papers on the effects on mental health in our community. As a matter of fact, when I was a young man, I used to get in a lot of trouble. So on one hand, I was really responsible and productive. My parents would teach me things like show up to work on time, show up to school, make good grades, if you make your own money and you can do what you want. And so on one hand, I was a really good kid. I showed up to work every day. I made good grades. I was on sports teams. I was well-liked, but I had this small problem. Is I kept getting arrested. So at the age of 17, I got my first DWI. I was still in high school. 2 years later, I got a drug possession. A year after that, another DWI. And 4 months after that, I got another drug possession, wondering, how did I get here again? Right? I didn't know anything about the disease of addiction or the chronic and progressive nature of behaviors or compulsive behaviors. I didn't know anything about substitution when it comes from like changing from one drug to another. I knew nothing about family or emotional dysfunction. And so at the age of 21, I was forced into strict probation. I was forced into treatment. I went to what's called rehab after work. So I'd go to work during the day and treatment at night. And I had one of the most important conversations that I had ever had with my counselor. You see, I thought I was 21 years old. I was sitting in this group therapy room with a bunch of old people, and man, they were old. They were like in their 30s or 40s or something. I mean,
watch it.
You know, so here I am. I'm a 21-year-old kid. I am. You know, I don't know much about the disease of addiction, the chronic and progressive nature of compulsive behavior. I tuck my shirt in. I could look you in the eyes and shake your hand and say, yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. And I knew how to show up to work, and I could pay my way. And so I'm sitting in this room with a bunch of old people. Their skin color is different than mine. Their religious beliefs are different than mine. Their backgrounds are different than mine. They're talking about losing families and jobs and houses, and I couldn't identify. And I'm sitting in the room with my counselor, and she says, I'm debating with her as to why I don't think I'm an alcoholic and why, since I'm 21, do I need to not drink? Because maybe I could have a problem with drugs. I mean, hey, drugs are illegal, but the legal ones, why can't I use those? Right? And so she had this really important conversation with me. She says, why is it with everything on the line, you're on strict probation, your probation officer says if you get in trouble one more time, you're going to jail. You're in alcohol and drug treatment right now. And we say you can't use any substances. And yet, with everything on the line, you're holding on to this substance and this behavior that you say is not an issue. She had me right there. I go, that's a good point. Why am I hanging on? Right? Because what I thought was, because I wasn't a mean drunk, because I wasn't a sloppy drunk, right? Because I didn't do all the things that we like to point out the person that's like the worst in the group. Because I wasn't that, I didn't think I had a problem. And so she convinced me that maybe I should attempt to maybe stop for a bit. And as of September the 10th of 2022, which was like a couple months ago, I celebrated 21 years in recovery. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that crazy? I was 21 years old. I just celebrated 21 years. This is a significant anniversary for me. But what's also important about that is I've got thousands of hours of experience doing all the things that I'm going to talk to y'all about. Right? So I didn't read this in a book. These are things that I do. Right? And when I started working for a mental health and addiction hospital and they put me on schools, courts, Department of Corrections, crisis teams, I started to see how the systems operate and go, something isn't right here. So this talk about demystifying mental and emotional health care is based on how can we simplify so we can get more people in the prevention business instead of the business that we're in now, which is crisis management. Right? Unless we're sick, we don't have a whole lot of solutions for you. So we're going to talk about demystifying mental and emotional health care. So the question is, where are we at right now? Where are we at in our culture, in our communities, in the organizations that we work for? Well, everybody knows we have a mental health and addiction crisis. It's just nobody knows exactly what to do. Or maybe you do know what to do, but your hands are tied because of red tape and we're kind of behind the times. Right, I heard a really great podcast, and they were talking about just general health care. And the guy says, we're actually, on average, 17 years, but let's just be generous, 10 to 15 years behind when it comes to what doctors, what our health care system is doing, what our criminal justice system is doing. We're about 10 to 15 years behind. So when some new research comes out that maybe this is about more than substance use. Maybe this is more about a mental health diagnosis. Maybe this is more about this healthcare issue. By the time it's discovered, the research, and getting and put in the hands of our doctors and care systems and criminal justice systems and courts and schools, it's about 15 years old. So if we're 10, 15, maybe 20 years behind, what do we do? Do we wait for the healthcare system to catch up? Do we wait till there's enough counselors and therapists and social workers and services available to start? Do we wait until insurance starts to pay for everything before we start? Right? So we're talking about demystifying mental and emotional health care. What do we do? Now, in the keynote, I'm going to talk a little bit more about family dysfunction, but I'm going to hit some points here. Anybody heard of John Bradshaw? You know, we talk about mental health and addiction as a crisis, as if it's something new. Our boy Johnny B, he did one of the most successful PBS specials, John Bradshaw, the family series, John Bradshaw, Homecoming, back in the 80s. Right? Homecoming. John Bradshaw, The Homecoming. It's a 10-part PBS series. He basically, it's 10 hours of detail from an expert family therapist, family system therapist, that talks, expands on what I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, when I saw the PBS special, I was like, well, what's the point of me doing this workshop? He's already covered it. I'll just direct everybody to YouTube. John Bradshaw is one of our foremost thought leaders talking about family systems. And he talks about, he's kind of famous for being quoted, 96% of families are to some degree emotionally dysfunctional. Isn't that crazy? Now, he's quick to point out on the PBS special, he goes, that's actually not my quote. There's a lady by the name of Virginia Satir who quotes 96% of families are dysfunctional. He said, me, John Bradshaw, I think 100% are dysfunctional. Right? So if we talk about addiction, mental health, emotional wellness, our issue is not mental illness. Our issue is not alcohol and drug addiction. It is, how do I handle my emotions when I get squeezed? This whole conference is talking about self-care. How can we take better care of ourselves? But what happens when I feel financial pressure? What happens when my six-year-old is throwing a fit and we're having a bit of a power struggle? What happens when I can just sense something's wrong with my wife and I think it's about me? What happens when I get squeezed? We're focusing on the wrong thing. When people come into 12-step recovery, we think our problem is alcohol and drugs. And then the more experienced members get to say, your alcohol and drug use is but a symptom. The way this is proven is, if alcohol and drug is the problem, all we got to do is quit using and everything is all good. But as many of you know, that's when everything starts. Right? Mental health and addiction is not our issue. It's emotional dysfunction. Here's one of the things I love that John says. He says, our society is emotionally sick because our families are emotionally sick. And our families are sick because we are living by inherited rules we never wrote. This ain't new, family. He said that in 1988. Why didn't my mom see this? Now, she probably did and go, nah, that's not me. Or, more honestly, everyone is trying to make changes and be different than our parents were. But what we don't realize is, A, how much time it takes to make real change, and B, when we, even though we know better, it doesn't necessarily mean we do better. Right? Knowing ain't enough, fam. Oh, I got, as I digress. So I would love to do this professionally one day, and I need pictures and maybe even video. So if anybody, I'd like for y'all to take pictures of my stuff, but if you snap a couple pics making me look good, like I know what I'm talking about, or you do a video, and then I'll put my cell phone up here and you can text it to me, that would be amazing, because I can put it on my website. Thank you. Selfish plug there. Hi. Now, where was I? Living by rules that we inherited that we didn't necessarily agree on. What kind of rules am I talking about? How about don't trust, don't feel? Don't trust, don't feel. Now, that comes, that belief system is fed to us in multiple ways. Right? My mother used to say things like, quit that crying before
I give you a reason to cry.
You better believe it. Now, here's what I want to point out real quick, because when I'm talking to groups of people, when I bump up against everything that you know to be true or your belief systems, you create some tension. I know I get uncomfortable when people are getting a little bit too close to home. What I want to impress upon you and to point out is, when we talk about emotional dysfunction, the reason I love this, the reason I love this figure is because that includes all of us. So when I'm talking to you, I'm talking to you from a place of me too, right? I'm talking to you from a place of not that my parents were terrible parents. They were just doing what was done to them, right? My belief is, and it's not everybody, but most people are trying to do the best they can with what they have and the information that they have, right? So when I talk to you and I bump up against something that maybe you believe to be true, I don't want you to mistake being a bad person, being a bad parent, with maybe not handling my emotions the way that the professionals would recommend, okay? I heard a lady on a podcast, she was an IFS therapist, internal family systems, and she was talking about parenting. And basically everything she said made sense, but I realized that I was doing everything incorrectly. And she goes, I studied this, I have a PhD, and I can only do it about 30% of the time. 70% of the time I'm screwing up. I like that because that's kind of what I do.
Hey, Preston. When you were talking about the, you said something about not making the changes or something. I wrote down this analogy. It made me think of people who go and get that weight surgery and lose all that weight, but don't change what got them there.
Yeah.
That's what made me think of.
So what Lisa's talking about is, are we addressing symptoms or are we addressing roots? Alcohol and drugs, symptoms. Roots, insecurity, self-esteem, self-worth, right? At any given moment, I don't feel worthy. At any given moment, I don't deserve to be up here because you don't need to hear what I have to say because you probably already know it. Right? At any given moment, and the way that comes out is in belief systems, compulsions, whether it's food, whether it's alcohol, whether it's being perfect, being a doer, whether it's pouring yourself in the name of love to others, but putting yourself at the bottom. If we only pay attention to the symptoms and never address the root, we are destined to repeat the same behavior, or that behavior changes clothes. How many people know what I mean by that? Your behavior changes clothes.
I'm talking about changing, not so much the behavior, but just the way you do it. For example, you choose about overeating. So instead of overeating, now you're overworking.
This girl's smart right here.
You think I'm drinking.
It's like whack-a-mole, right? We have that. Why do you think people that struggle with the disease of addiction that get into recovery keep going back all the time, right? Because we talk about character defects and shortcomings is the moment I think I got it, it morphs into something else and then I'm acting out in a different area. Talking about belief systems and inherited rules we never wrote. Don't trust, don't feel. Quit that crying before I give you something to cry about. What that's telling me is that my emotions are not valid. I think I must have been doing something wrong. Therefore, how I feel is incorrect. And if I don't change my behavior, I will be punished and then told I do this because I love you. Right? I'm talking about thoughts and beliefs that we inherited, and when we grow up, we think they're ours. My mom would say things. My mom was raised in a Church of Christ Children's Home. She was dropped off at the age of 6 with her brothers and sisters because her dad abandoned the family. Moved to California without saying anything to anybody, which is what his dad did to him. My grandmother, my mom's mom, was in and out of psych institutions just like her grandmother was. She was put into a children's home, which in my mom's words were, she was lucky because it was a nicer one. Right? She would say things like, I believe in spare the rod, spoil the child. Right? One of the biggest hurdles that I have with my 6-year-old son is this obsession of not having a spoiled child. Right? So even though I might say and do the right things, he feels the emotional dysfunction because I can hear my mother, but it's actually not my mother anymore, it's my words. Can you understand why it is so difficult to diagnose dysfunction that unless you're acting out, we don't know what's going on? As a matter of fact, you don't know what's going on. We do this because I love you. Love means punishment. Don't be too full of yourself. Who do you think you are to wear that outfit? A man doesn't do that. Take that makeup off. You don't look like a lady. Don't stick out too much. You don't want to be up here. Now, you don't want to be down here. We need to blend in the middle. Who you are isn't good enough. What you like isn't good enough. What you're interested in isn't good enough. Look at your grades. You don't measure up. Right? So these are ideas and belief systems that we interpret and internalize as children. Then we become adults, right? And we think, we don't know, oh, that actually didn't make a whole lot of sense, and I'd actually developed a coping skill to take care of that. We actually think that this is our belief system. And then what do? We pass it to our kids. Right? Confusing, you know, like morphing. I can't think of the term. Is most people go, here's all the areas in which my parents screwed up. I'm going to do it differently. Right? But what ends up happening is we overcompensate or we create the dysfunction in a different way. One of the biggest things was my father used to say his dad would beat the crap out of him. He ruled the house with an iron fist. His mother was paralyzed, so if my dad didn't listen, when my grandfather got home in the middle of the night or late, he would pull him out of bed and spank him with a belt. Right? My dad hated it. But my dad was confused. He was in a pickle because he believed in discipline, but he didn't believe in beating the crap out of you. Right? Isn't that interesting how we go, well, we didn't do it that way. We do that. Right? So he would still spank me with a belt. And so I said, well, I want to develop the parenting skills to not spank. I even feel uncomfortable saying that because that almost seems like my childhood, what my parents did, was wrong. Isn't that weird? Like, this tendency, because we need to make sense of our caregivers, we stuff down the bad, we reach up, lift up the good, and then we find it hard to change the behavior. But what's the difference between physically spanking my son and shaming my son? Right? Being verbally abusive. Right? So people would sit around and go, well, I don't spank my kid. But if you watched how they discipline their child, they are so verbally abusive, instilling the same shame, guilt, and self-esteem issues. I'm talking about demystifying mental and emotional health care. If we can't get in the prevention business, we're never going to make the change. We're not going to be able to destigmatize and normalize, so we keep people in services before they actually need it. John Bradshaw, look him up. We love him. Biggest mistake. So John Bradshaw talks about family systems therapy. One of my favorite types of therapy is called internal family systems, which means it is a family system. It's not just someone that is sick. And so anybody ever heard of the Rudolph effect? Oh, man, it's been researched. There's been books written about it. It's amazing. I'm just kidding. I made it up. It just sounds good. The Rudolph Effect. I work for a mental health and addiction hospital. I get calls every day saying, help my son, help my wife, help my kids, help my neighbor. It's never the person that's sick. The family rallies around the worst person in the family, and we think, Lisa, you know this one, and we think if we could just fix him, her, them, they could come back in the family and we could be what?
Whole and normal.
Whole and normal. Right? And so I had these conversations. They go, what do we do? And I go, well, here's what we need to do. We need to get them into treatment. We need to do this. We need to make sure they follow the levels of care or whatever. And then I change the conversation before we get off the phone and things get very uncomfortable. Because I go, now that we've taken care of your husband and what we're going to do for his alcoholism, now you need to start going to family groups. Now you need to start getting your kids into services as well. And they go, whoa, 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 whoa. We're fine. We need to fix my husband, right? So we have the Rudolph effect. The reason why Rudolph makes so much sense is because he's the one with the big red nose everybody's paying attention to, but we don't realize we're all connected. So everybody in our family system is connected. We just have different roles. I don't know if anybody y'all can identify with this, but how many of you became the performer, the perfect one, the straight A student? They took care of everything to give your family something to be proud of. I'm talking symptoms versus root. The brother who's getting arrested all the time, the sister that's being perfect, suffering from the same root issues of the dysfunctional family system. The way that they chose to cope was different. And one is lifted up as good, and one is lifted up as bad. What's even more sick is, the one that's lifted up as good is told, who you are isn't enough. You're only enough if you're performing. We're talking about dysfunctional families and how do I handle my emotions, not what do we need to diagnose as behavior. There's a big difference between behavior modification, take this medication, quit touching the doorknob six different times, let's modify this behavior, as opposed to what are we stressed about? How do we handle uncertainty? How do we get out of hypervigilance and not focusing on the behavior? I'm talking about dysfunctional family systems that we all typically focus on the worst in the family, the worst in the community. Here's what makes it also very difficult to diagnose is we tend to hang around with who?
People who agree with us and think like us.
We hang with people that look like us, agree with us, parent like us, have similar religious beliefs. We'll say things like, oh, I know people that aren't religious. Right? But we have the same... You ever had it where like someone's just got a good vibe, you just vibe with them, right? The funny thing is they've got the same dysfunctional vibration as you. That's why they feel familiar. I did a study abroad in South America. There they are. I know. And you go, oh my God, you're so different. I love you. And if you dig a little deeper, they just come from the same stuff. It just looks different. They feel familiar. I went to South America. I was in South America for 5 months. I parachuted in, and guess who I started hanging out with? I was sober. I was in school. I was away from all my friends and family. Who do you think I started hanging out with? The crazy folk. Right? The fun people. Right? They were maybe they weren't alcoholic and drug addicts, but you ask a couple questions and we go, strict religion. Broken home, divorced family, mom's crazy, right? Those are my people. We find our people, which makes it very difficult to diagnose. Now, let's talk about mental wellness plan. Now, there's a reason why I use the terms mental wellness, mental and emotional health care, because what happens when you hear mental health? Tell me what happens. When I say, let's talk about mental health, what do you think of?
Sick, crazy.
Sick, crazy. Yeah?
My mother.
What is it?
My mother.
Yes, yes, yes. Do you think it's important we talk about mental health?
Yes.
Right? So what's crazy about when I ask people, do you think we need to do more for mental health and addiction services? The entire room raises their hand. But what I know is that most people go, yes, it's important, but for who? I'm fine. We need to help my brother, my cousin, my mom, my sister, right? So what ends up happening is we go to these destigmatized rallies. We go to, like, let's get more mental health services in the home or in the schools, right? I talked to a lot of schools. Let's do all this stuff, but I don't need the help. They do. It's what's called detachment. We are detaching from the problem. So what might a mental wellness plan look like? I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in the keynote. However, actually, I'm going to talk about it here too. But to give us an idea of what a mental wellness plan looks like, let's come up with a physical wellness plan. Do I have any dietitians or personal trainers in the house? Perfect. So we got a...
All right, good.
So maybe you can help us, keep us on track. But really, we got a bunch of kind of normies, and we're going to come up with a fitness plan. Now, I don't want to lose a bunch of weight. We're not talking about anything crazy. I'm 42, and I'm getting softer, and I need to, like, start looking at my health a little bit. That's what I'm talking about. All right, so let's come up with a physical wellness plan. Should we work out if we want to get a little bit healthier?
Yes.
How many times a week, and understand there's going to be a range, there's going to be a start, anything's better than nothing, but if we talk about averages, how many times a week should we work out?
It's better to do at least 20 minutes of some kind of moderate exercise every day.
There you go. So every day, so that'd be 20 minutes for 7 days a week, an hour 3 to 5 days a week. Right? 30 minutes. And yes, understand, if you're going from the couch to working out, 10 to 20 minutes is good. But eventually, you're going to get bored with that. You get stronger, so you increase, right? Let's call it 4 to 5 days a week. 30 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on what you're doing. Should we do anything about our eating if we want to get a bit healthier?
Yes.
Yeah. Does that mean if we're doing something about our eating, should we maybe spend more time preparing and planning our meals so we don't just dip into Wendy's when I get hungry? Good. Should we spend more time at the grocery store?
Yes.
Should we maybe keep a food journal until we kind of figure out what that looks like, so until we kind of figure it out?
Yes.
Should we join a gym or a group fitness class?
If you can afford it.
If you can afford it. Let's say we can. Let's say we can. Good. Why would we join a gym or a group fitness class?
Hold you accountable.
Yeah.
Support.
Right? I'm really big when we're talking about support groups. I'm not saying your friends aren't good and don't have your best intentions at heart. And I'm not saying your mother doesn't love you. But they're in the same boat, if you know what I'm saying. Right? It's like the blind leading the blind. We're encouraging people in a dysfunctional way. Right? That's why we're friends. I like being around people that the only thing you have in common is the thing you're trying to change. That's why gyms and group fitness classes are really important, right? I'm not going to do it if I'm by myself, but if I know you're doing it, then maybe I'll do it, right? Should I maybe ask someone that has more experience than me maybe for help so I can learn from them? That sounds good, right? Should we look for new people to come in and saying, hey, I'll help you because I'm a little bit ahead, and actually helping them does what for me? That's right. What else do we have? Is there anything else that I'm missing if we're going to do physical fitness?
Sleep.
Good. How many hours a week, if we're just including shopping, cooking, working out, driving to the gym, doing the group fitness class, accountability calls with my friend, journaling, all the kind of stuff. How many hours? Let's just guess. Doesn't need to be perfect. How many hours a week do you think we should spend on our physical wellness plan?
3 hours? Oh, a day?
You said a week. A week. I don't know, 20 hours? 40 hours, that's a lot. Let's just be kind of in the middle. Let's say 10 to 15 hours a week. That is a bunch of normies sitting in a room in Sandusky came up with a pretty damn good physical wellness plan, not to necessarily get a six-pack, but maybe to lose a little bit of weight and our blood work looks better. right? What is the standard wellness plan for mental health or addiction? How many hours a week? If you did what your counselor told you to do, how many hours a week would the average person spend on their mental health? Now, I got a couple counselors in the room. I think maybe they might be running through their head how many hours they think it should be. Generally speaking, going to see your counselor on a weekly basis is actually high achieving. That would be 1 hour a week. The average person sees a counselor or therapist how many times a month?
One
to two. And as a matter of fact, if we want to be in the prevention business and not crisis management business, we need a crap load more therapists. We need a crap load more counselors. We need a crap load more social workers. They need to make a good wage, not $35,000 after they just got their master's. Right? Because even if everybody in here said, "Press, I'm going to do whatever you say," you can oftentimes you can't even get a counselor to see you. You're on a wait list. And even if they wanted to, they can't see you every week. Right? How is that so off? And we wonder why we're in a mental health crisis and we can't change long-term family dysfunction.
Our students are the same in the prison system.
100%.
They can't get in to see their mental health person, or they don't get to see them enough. Or
that's right. So here's what the thing that I my mission in life. So one of the things is, if we want to get normalized mental health and addiction, we want to get more people into prevention. My age group kept getting younger and younger and younger. So we got my people, which are like people have been arrested, drug addicts, alcoholics. They're really obvious. Usually they're older. Then I'm thinking parents. Well, parents need help. You know, when people call about kids, it's actually, well, it's not just the kid, it's the parent. And then it's going, well, how can I get more kids into services? And so what I learned was the vast majority of people, even people in the business, counseling and therapy, they don't even understand full level of care. What's the difference between coaching, counseling, therapy, psychiatry, support groups, intensive mental health groups, inpatient, residential, PHP, IOP? Most people don't even know all the stuff. I mean, they can figure it out. But what if we had schools that didn't just teach their mental health specialists and counselors, but taught their teachers in 30 seconds to a minute to say, here's what we have as far as a level of care services in the school. Have some services for them. Here's the services that we have outside the school. And I know you're a great parent, probably don't have any problems, but if you ever do, we have these available. Right? And we start in elementary school. It's just a quick thing, blip, we've got it, see ya. They don't even need to explain all this stuff. Right?
They don't want to spend the money.
Huh?
They don't want to spend the money.
That's right. Then, that is a big problem. That goes back to, we all know there's an issue, but everybody sees it from a different range, which means administrators and principals say, we've all got processes in place, and then you talk to teachers and counselors, and they go, oh my God, it's a crap show, and then parents are like, we can't get anything done, right? But if we could get this, something like this in a school, and it's customized for every school, not stuff for Ohio, like, what's in your local community? Right? And then we have services. It's a one page in normal language, not clinical language, that someone could pick it up off the floor, read what these services are, and understand it. Right? What's the difference between coach, counseling, therapy, etc.? Now, 80 to 90% of people will never need more than level one or two. Right? You see, I've got five levels. They'll never need more than level one or two. Coaching. This is like life coaching, leadership coaching, parent coaching, all the biz. Now, the reason I like this, one, my wife is a women's leadership coach. She's absolutely excellent. If you're looking for something cool to do, I'll leave her information up here. Coaching, they typically focus on goals, desires, and potential. Often, this is a good starter because a lot of people go, hey, there's nothing wrong with me, but I got goals and dreams, and I'd like to focus on potential. Now, it's a great starter. Now, once you get into coaching, you realize there's a lot of emotional work, right, to be done. But it's very expensive. It's usually business, or it's like, maybe it's my wife's a confidence and self-esteem coach. She ends up working a lot with people on that. But it can get people started. And if things are working properly, they go, whoa, we just uncovered some trauma that's above my pay grade. We should get you into therapy, right? If things are working properly. Now, do coaches counsel? Do counselors coach? So the answer is coaches do some counseling, but are they counselors? The answer is they are not. Very different. What's a counselor? They typically deal with coping skills, self-esteem, handling emotional turmoil. They typically work with you on broader topics, shorter term. Now, there's all different levels of counseling. There's a counselor that all you need is an associate, a CDCA, chemical dependency counselor assistant, associate, something like that. There's bachelor's and master's level counselors, licensed professional mental health counselors. There's licensed professional clinical counselors. There's all different variations. And do counselors therapize? Like therapists. Therapize. Sure. Do therapists counsel? Sure. Are they the same thing?
No.
No. Because therapists, these are typically your social workers, psychologists, clinical professionals. They need usually at least a bachelor's, more than likely it's a master's or higher, right? Therapists are working more specifically on types of behavior, different diagnoses. They're working with you for a longer period of time. Childhood, if you uncover some childhood trauma, you know, you probably need to get with a therapist. It's going to help you kind of work. PTSD, sexual trauma, that's usually a therapist, because counselors a lot of times can't do all that. They can help, but at some point, you might need to go a little bit higher up the scale. One of the biggest misconceptions in this industry is what a psychiatrist does. Psychiatrist, a doctor of psychiatry, at this same level that would be a medical doctor, a pediatrician, a family practitioner, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, they're all in the same category. What do psychiatrists do? Their only job is to prescribe medication, right? Now, will they spend time with you? Sure. Do they ask you how you're feeling? Sure. They're gathering information to figure out if we need to change your medication, right? The average doctor spends 7 minutes per patient. The average psychiatrist spends 15 to 20 minutes per patient. If you have a psychiatrist, are you in therapy?
No,
you are not. The amount of people that say, oh yeah, I've got a therapist, and what they do is they have someone prescribing them medication, right? I got a great psychiatrist. They're asking me how I feel, and they agree with me and do some reflective listening. That is not therapy. Why is it that so many adults and kids are on so much medication? More medication than we've ever been on in our human history. Why? Because the average person does not have any grasp on the basics and level of care when it comes to mental health, emotional health, and behavioral health, is that their first stop is where?
The medical doctor.
The medical doctor. And medical doctors do what medical doctors are supposed to do, is they see their parents, their patients as sick, that they can fix the problem with. We're talking about symptoms versus roots, right? A parent, you have a question?
Actually, that quick fix, everybody wants the quick fix. I have a weight issue, give me a pill,
yes.
Give me the fix.
Yes.
So that's part of the problem too.
100%. Yeah, and that's been happening since the beginning of time, so to think that that's anything new, it's not. It's just different now, right? Some of our biggest challenges, particularly around kids, is we think our kids are so different than us. The only difference is we're in the information age, which means we have so much more access to information and we're distracted a lot more. So the feelings and emotional dysfunction that we grew up with as kids manifested differently. So we think, oh, it's the times. It's not the times. It's the emotionally dysfunction that was passed down from generation to generation. Right? Psychiatry, they prescribe medication. First stop should be counselors, therapists, etc. Maybe even your doctor, but doctors should be let's try counseling first, not you're depressed, let me give you some medication. That's why you get people that are in their 20s that have been on six different medications, they can't understand why they keep getting depressed. Now, the level of care that I work in, that I typically deal with, is high level of care. So we're talking, someone goes to the emergency room, they're suicidal, strung out, hearing stuff, seeing stuff. Mom and dad didn't know what to do, take them to the emergency room. The emergency room is trying to determine, can we send them home safely or do they need to go somewhere? Then they go somewhere and they send them to Columbus Springs or Dublin Springs or Highland Springs or Beckett Springs or OHP or whatever the thing is, right? And they dose them up with medication. They keep them for how long?
72 hours.
There you go. 3 to 7 days. That is just stabilization, right? So if you go to the hospital, Nationwide Children's is a big hospital in Columbus. There's other children's hospital. But you have a child that goes to the hospital level 5, and they get sent back home and back to school, which is level 1. How is that even possible? Now, there's a lot of variations of, like, you know, you don't want to refer kids up too fast, or adults, right? You want to slowly do it. But what ends up happening is they ping pong back and forth, 5 to 1, 5 to 1, 5 to 1. Nobody knows what's going on, right? So, inpatient hospitalization, stabilization, 3, 5, 7 days. Rehab, which is residential rehab, that's where you get into the 30, 60, 90-day drug and alcohol rehab. They do not have rehab for mental health. Why? First off, psych wards and institutions got a bad rap back in the day, so they shut them all down, right? And guess what? Insurance doesn't have to pay for it, so why would they? Right? So the step down is inpatient to partial hospitalization. Partial hospitalization means that you're partially hospitalized. You go home at night, you come to the doctor's office or the group during the day, you're doing 30 hours of intensive mental health therapy. That makes sense, doesn't it? If you're in inpatient, 24/7 lockdown, inpatient, you're staying somewhere that's not at home, that's 24/7, it would make sense that you drop down to doing 30 hours a week. And once you're doing better, you drop down and you do 9 to 12, which is in the form of intensive outpatient therapy, right? Just because someone, that these gaps, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient therapy, is the gap between you need more than just counseling, but you don't have to go to the hospital, or you've been to the hospital, and you can't just go right back home and try to manage it an hour a week and go to school or be in your own same dysfunctional environment. Basic level of care education for all is one of the solutions to normalizing and destigmatizing. It's not just the counselors and mental health specialists that should know this. Now, there's a reason why they do it that way, because they also don't want teachers and random parents saying, I think you need IOP. They don't know that. But what we need to do is start to do some education to put it out there. There's a book out there that they talk about being a fisher of men, right? We need to be throwing the hook out, just letting people know these services are available, throwing the hook out. And then someone goes, hey, we're kind of having a problem, can we talk? Then we get them into somewhere, and then we say, hey, we'll help you figure out where they're going. I always run out of time. Can you tell I like this topic? Yes, thank you. One of the polls that I did is, what's the most underutilized resource that we have at our fingertips? I got the answer on them. The most underutilized resource that we have at our fingertips is free. And we're walking around going, we don't have enough services. There's not enough. Remember, we're 10 to 15 years behind. Insurance doesn't have to pay for stuff. I didn't even get into why so many people, even if they want to go to see a counselor or a therapist, or if someone wants to go into the business of being a counselor. You heading out? Okay. Typically, the more experience a counselor or therapist gets, or a doctor, their pay should do what? When they get better at something, should you get paid more or less? But according to insurance, because they're a publicly traded company and their commitment is to shareholders and not community, that they determine the reimbursements. So our insurance premium goes up, coverage goes down, but what they cover goes down. We don't know it until you need it. So pay goes down, reimbursements go down. So you're a veteran therapist who's killing the game. And your pay goes down every year because reimbursements are going down. At some point you go, one, I max out, I want to make more money. But at some point you go, screw the insurance, I'm going to do self-pay only. as one should. You should, you get better, you should make more. But who does that help? What category of our population is at a disadvantage once again? Right? And it's not just the poor. The average middle class family can't afford an extra $100, $200, $300 a month, fam. Right? This is crazy. Much less the whole family get in. You telling me you want me to spend $500 to $1,000, Preston, on my mental health therapy and family? No. I want you to go to free support groups. And I want you to treat your mental and emotional health care like you would or your physical health care. Bump all this an hour a week crap. How can we get you to 10 hours a week? How can I get you to be a high achiever and get up to 20 hours a week on how you handle your emotions, not how do you not be bipolar? Right? If you work on your emotions, I got a sneaking suspicion that your struggles with your mental illness might change. Now, I am pro-diagnosis, I am pro-medication. Do not confuse what I'm saying. Right? But somehow I imagine if I'm more emotionally stable, I parent differently. If I'm more emotionally regulated, I don't rely on substances, drugs, alcohol, food, porn, spending, hoarding money, distracting behavior. Now, why are support groups good? Well, they offer a place to go regularly, a safe environment that's non-judgmental, that hopefully you can be open and honest. You have some form of anonymity and confidentiality, right? And this is my biased opinion. Experience trumps everything. Experience trumps everything. That if I know that you've been where I've been and you've gotten out of it, that you're not telling me something you read in a book or you're not experimenting with my life. What does that mean? Experimenting with my life. Right? How many people do you know, or maybe you've done it because I've done it, is because I'm so caring and I want to help, I tell people, try this, try that, try this. I've never actually done it, experienced it. I'm trying to help. But the higher the acuity, the higher the severity, we begin experimenting with people's lives in drug addiction and mental health. This is life or death. I don't want to know what you think. I want to know what you did when you did it and what the results were. I want to hear some hope that you've gotten out of the place that you were. Right? And here's the other thing. Remember we talked about, this is a bunch of normies who came up with a physical wellness plan. It's not about knowledge. It's not about knowing what we should do or could do. It's not even about wanting to do it or needing to do it. We hear it all the time. Oh, they just don't want it. Right? You got to want it. No, you don't. You think I wanted to get clean and sober? I went kicking and screaming. I did not want what you had to offer. Right? So we have to go somewhere on a consistent basis, because every time I wake up, I forget all the stuff I know I'm supposed to do. Right? How many people love to change behavior when you're in the behavior and you're at the end of the day? Here's what I mean. It's always easy to quit when you're already drunk and high and you're like, tomorrow. It's always easy to quit when your belly's full. You just stuff down a thing of Ben and Jerry's, right? You go, tomorrow's going to be different. And we go to sleep and we wake up and all the subconscious behaviors kick in and we go back to what we're doing. We have no accountability partners, but don't worry. We're going to see our counselor in 2 weeks, right? Why don't people utilize support groups? I'll give you a couple reasons. Most people don't think they qualify. You're not a drug addict or alcoholic, where am I going to go? Right? If things aren't really bad, why would I go? They're scary. What if they offer my kids or my family drugs? Seen that on TV. Right? What are some other reasons why people don't go to support groups? Stigma. Judged. It bumps up against everything you believe to be true. Who wants to feel like a piece of crap? I already feel like a piece of crap. I don't want to go in there and have them make me feel more like a piece of crap. I am a failure as a father. That's why I'm here. Who wants to feel that way? You're going
to
say something. Now, you're all right. I would just say this briefly. Not all support groups are created equally. What I mean by that is I am biased towards support groups that have been established over a long period of time. In other words, for example, like 12-step support groups, AA, NA, CA, OA, all these 12-step groups, they have an established like tradition, some guidelines. They do things to talk about like anonymity, who you see here, what you hear here stays here. They have like no cross-talking advice if you don't have any experience in that, right? They have a kind of a foundation. You know, the average person goes, my son is having problems with mental health. I'm going to start a support group. Well, it's nice, but it can very quickly be very dysfunctional, codependent. You know, some organizations, you know, they have offer support groups or called support groups, but they say, well, if you don't come here, you're a bad person, so you show up, and then you read out of a book that says if you don't do this and you do this, that means you're a bad person, and then it becomes this, like, codependent, dysfunctional relationship, and we go, we don't understand. I like things that are more non-denominational, established. But you ask, I don't know where to go. Well, if you go to my keynote, you're going to get some more information, which is based off of ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunction. That's a very good one. If you have family that struggle with drug addiction, alcoholism, even parents, grandparents, Al-Anon's a great one. If you have kids that raised an alcoholic or drug addicted home, Alateen. NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness. These are, that's kind of like the support network for mental illness. If you have families, if you have a brother or a cousin or whatever, they have family support groups. Do you have a question or you just?
Yeah, question.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the support groups in those areas, since they're broken out, what if you have a person that is not only mental health but alcoholic too?
Sure. Often, it kind of depends on where they're at, but I say go, do more, and often.
Okay. So hit both and.
Or, yeah, just go get in where you fit in. This is very, very, I want to share this in. Oh my God, I got 3 minutes. I want y'all to take a picture of this, take a picture of that. These are just resources, books, alternative resources. Here's my wife's coaching, John Bradshaw specials, a lot of these great books. Here's the deal. Mel Robbins, she was on a podcast. Here's another reason why it's very difficult to establish new behaviors. The podcast was called Call Her Daddy. Anybody heard of Call Her Daddy? Has anybody taken pictures of me now that I'm up here? Oh, good. Thank you. And my cell phone's going to be up here, too, so make sure you text them to me. Call Her Daddy. She was talking about 20-somethings, females. It was called, like, Where Did All My Friends Go? And what Mel Robbins said was one of the most interesting things was, she goes, building friendships has a lot to do with proximity, which is why we have a tendency to be friends with the people that we grew up with or that we went to school with or that we work with, right? And for kids and young adults, it takes about 40 hours of shared experience with someone, not just in the room together, but like shared experience, to go from like acquaintance to friend. And then to go from like friend to like close friend, it goes from 40 hours to about 60 hours. Okay? That's how much time it takes for young people to establish relationships. For adults, 90 hours to go from acquaintance to friend. And then to go from friend to good friend, it goes from 90 hours to 160 hours. Have you ever wondered why it's so hard to build new friendships as an adult? Right? And if we think of, in 12-step recovery, in drug addiction or alcoholism, we say, it's a good idea to make at least 90 meetings in 90 days when you get clean. But so many people, why they don't end up going, because they're not the ones whose butt's falling off. They go, wow, that sounds extreme. Maybe they go to these support groups. They're speaking these weird languages. They're reading these weird books. I already feel uncomfortable. It makes me feel like a terrible person. I'm out. But if we go off of Mel Robbins' example, What if we committed to 90 hours? I was just talking to Lisa. When you get hired on a new job, brand new, how many hours do you do training? How many hours?
40 hours.
40 hours. Usually it's 2 weeks. That's 80 hours of training, right? 80 hours of training. It takes at least 6 months to get any kind of resemblance of like normalcy, and usually up to about a year to really feel comfortable. And yet when we're talking about changing the direction of our family's lives that has been passed down from generation to generation, we want to help them. We want to save our marriage. We want to help our kids. We want to help our family. We want to do 2 hours a month? We want to quit after 3 meetings? Well, of course that feels weird. Commit to 90 hours. Do 90 hours of research. I'll say this and wrap up. This is my all my contact information. I got a podcast called High Cost of Anonymity. If I'm talking all this mess about personal development, I better show you how to do it. It's kind of like a personal journal. I put that on there. My wife, women's leadership coach, she works on, she coaches people anywhere from like, you know, moms that are trying to figure out what to do, young people that are in college to like high-level professionals at Google and Facebook. She's got a pump-up mini retreat she does every week, a membership. She's just writing a blog. She's just a bundle of energy. One of the most valuable things that we got out of year 2020 is access to virtual meetings, virtual school, right? You can... If you commit to 90 hours, you don't got to do it in 90 days. 90 hours, you can log on to Zoom meetings and just listen like a podcast. You don't even have to show up in person. In person trumps everything because you need to build local community. Podcasts, recovery podcasts, story. You hear people, ACA, which is about family dysfunction. There's a podcast called Tuesday Zoom Box, I think is what it's called. It used to be Tuesday Toolbox. It's just people sharing their lead, right? Search Al-Anon speaker. Search ACA speaker. Search mental health speaker.
Yo, family. Hey, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you learned something new. And if you know someone that would benefit from a workshop like this, if you organize conferences, if you work for a school or community organization, if there is a group that you think would benefit from a workshop like this about normalizing mental health and addiction, demystifying mental and emotional health care, make sure you holler at your boy. I love you.